Welcome to the Speakeasy with Kate Wand, a safe space to discuss liberal ideas.
Great. How are things in Canada? Is there a sense of any waking up happening, or is the audience still psychosed, hypnotized?
Well, it's kind of interesting because I think that they're still psychos. They've been lining up for these rapid tests and getting these antigen tests to bring home with them, and everybody's obsessed with testing. But it's funny because they know, like, they watch even on the mainstream news now, they're saying that, well, the Omicron variant is really, you know, quite mild. It's pretty much like a cold and all of this. So it's really interesting to watch because they're aware of that, but they still want to partake in it regardless.
Yeah, it's that talks a bit to Matthias Desmet's theory that a sense of community has been found in the in the religion of the response.
Yes.
And so even and he also makes the point that people who are in that position will never let the facts get in the way of the good story, you know.
No.
So that makes sense to me. I don't find that too surprising. It's horrible, but it's not too surprising.
Well, I just started reading last night the second book, which is actually the first publication of Hannah Arendt, The Origins of Totalitarianism. And right in there, as soon as you get in, you see that that's kind of reinforcing those ideas that the original story that was built to kind of catalyze the mass formation, by the end of it, is no longer relevant at all. It doesn't matter. Like, it's already disappeared.
Mm. Interesting.
It's the energy that's important.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. I mean, here in South Africa, I'm finding it's more and more often you see people who have just, you can tell there's something about them. They have a different bearing. They look like they've snapped out of it.
That's good.
And, you know, the very interesting thing for me has been when we published our first article and there was all this backlash against it and people calling us all sorts of names right at the beginning, I remember I suddenly became alt-right and a libertarian and, you know, the usual COVID denier and all these things. And you kind of had the impression that everybody was against you, you know. And so when I started becoming recognizable to people just by virtue of sustained outcry, I kind of was a bit disconcerted every time somebody approached me because I was expecting that, you know, 4 out of 5 people will be there to tell me what a horrible person I am. And, you know, it's never happened once. It seldom happens that I go out in a public place now where I'm not recognized and somebody doesn't approach me. But to this day, I've never had a single person approach me and say, Mr. Hudson, I'm here to tell you that you are a horrible man. You know, that has never happened in hundreds of such incidents. So now when people approach me, I'm completely, it does require a little bit of extra budgeting of time, but I generally have just very nice interactions with people thanking me or telling me their story or trying to give me a piece of information that they think I ought to have or something like that. You know, that's all of it. It's not like it's just the majority. It's all of it. And that's so strange because when you read the social media and the people who are writing comments and newspaper articles and all that kind of thing, there's quite a bit of criticism. And a lot of it is very uncivilized, you know, it's just name calling and so on. But in real life, the most I ever get is kind of a snarky look. You know, some people at another table at a restaurant will go, "Oh, that's that guy," you know. And you can see that kind of conversation going down, but they never approach you, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think too, it speaks to the fact that the media is kind of like a warped mirror. Like it no longer reflects what the majority of people think. I think that it really represents that those ideological zealots more than anyone. And so some people who just aren't thinking, they get dragged along with the narrative and they're really fearful and they just take everything at face value. But probably, again, coming back to Matthias Desmet, when he talks about that 40% of people who aren't with the program, but they don't directly contradict it. It could be that right. Maybe those are the people who are coming up to you, right? They just think that they're kind of probably thinking like this is a leader, like he's saying things that I don't want to say, or I feel like I can't say, or maybe I don't know how to express, you know, like, yeah. And that's, I've had, there's a friend of mine, a local friend who, she's been quite scapegoated. She is a small business owner. And then there's one really vile woman in the area who just has been pointing out everybody who's not vaccinated and this and that, and really trying to rally against them. But she's held pretty strong. But what she always says to me is, you know, Kate, I just don't know the way to express this to people. Like, you know all the facts. I don't know how to explain to people. Like, I know that it's bullshit, but I don't know how to say it in a way that makes sense, you know? Like, and then they get attacked by somebody and they don't feel like they have the intellectual argument. Right?
100%. I do get that. The people who, I think they've absorbed enough of it, but they're not confident enough to hold their own in a kind of debate or an argument. Mm-hmm. But they have an intuition and they've absorbed enough facts. So they kind of form categories, you know, in their own minds, the following things are in the bullshit category. And they can't quite cite the evidence or the literature or the or rebut all the counter arguments. They don't know what to say about those, but their tummy tells them where they are. And I think those are the people. The thing that I was still totally blown away by was that your elections came out the way they did. That surprised me, because I thought those people would vote differently.
Yes.
So Trudeau getting 35% support for me was very surprising. Very surprising.
But you know, like, I think that it was so disappointing for me, and I didn't expect that completely. But part of me, maybe the realist, the pessimist realist part of me, was thinking that was a great possibility. And, you know, the reason is because they're looking for that. It used to be like maybe 100 years ago, people were looking for a strong man, you know, to lead the way when they were lost. But now they're looking for the soy boy to lead the way when they're lost.
Yes, it is like that. How do you get there, though? I mean, you know, but there is a spectacular unraveling underway, Kate. I mean, I can understand if you don't maybe feel it in Canada, but in South Africa, it's just everywhere. I mean, we have had establishment scientists who've done nothing but trumpet the narrative for the better part of 2 years, come out with some extraordinary negations of that narrative. They tend to take on one issue, you know, and so, for example, on the 17th of December, two of the mainstream scientists in South Africa, one of whom is very closely associated with the Gates Foundation and the other one who's heavily funded by the Gates Foundation, they came out and said, oh, you know, the case for contact tracing is weak. And they tried to say it's Omicron is different and it's because of that, you know, the facts have changed. But of course it hasn't. The facts haven't changed. The contact tracing was always a stupid idea for respiratory virus of high transmissibility. they actually shifted government policy for a week. And then the government came out and withdrew the circular that had ended asymptomatic testing and quarantining of asymptomatic people. They withdrew that circular, citing outside pressure and media pressure.
Wow.
So, you know, one of the guys in our circles wrote a letter saying, okay, well, you need to tell us who's providing that pressure, just as a prequel to a freedom of information type approach to government to actually get the names, you know. Yeah. But that was the one. And then today, a professor from our National Institute of Communicable Diseases came out saying, look, there isn't any evidence to support what she termed off-the-shelf face masks. but then very strangely, she negated something that the other two scientists had been saying, which was that, oh, you know, the reason we all need to acknowledge that the transmission is by respiratory airborne aerosols. And so, you know, that this kind of social distancing doesn't really work, you know. That was one of the things they'd said. But she came out, her reasoning for why masks are probably not effective is because of fomite transmission, people touching their faces when they've got masks on, you know, so it introduces the virus to them. And of course, fomite transmission has no basis in science. It's a part of the bogus narrative. So she was using one part of the bogus narrative to negate another part, which is very strange. And I think we're going to be in for a lot of it. And I've also had some personal exchanges with these scientists that seem to suggest to me that they're becoming a little bit deranged. On Christmas Eve, I suddenly started getting a string of direct messages from the one scientist. And they were really unhinged. You know, I'd actually sent him a note to say, you know, that I didn't agree with everything in your article, but I admire the fact that you'd written it. And do you think that the government is going to respond to it? You know, it was just a kind of conciliatory article. There was no conciliation to be done because I've never had any direct contact with him before, but he follows me on Twitter. Yeah. I follow him. So I DM'd him and said, you know, I thought your piece was helpful. Well done, kind of thing. And 4 days later on Christmas Eve at nighttime when everybody's having their Christmas Eve dinner, he writes to me saying, don't send me friendly messages while publicly calling for Nuremberg-style trials for me and my colleagues, you two-faced hypocrite. You know, that's what he said. And that was just the beginning of a rant. And what was so interesting is, you know, I've never called for Nuremberg-style trials. And in fact, I think I've had the conversation with you where I've said, I think this thing's too big. You need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you know, like South Africa. So I've actually kind of... I've been I go to a less harsh position, you know, a more moderate position. And so, but that's his perception, is that there are all these people out there who are so cross at what's happened that they're after our blood. And he's that upset that he will write to me at 9:30 p.m. on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And carry on writing and engaging, you know. Yeah. It's gone on for weeks now. I still had another DM from him this morning. I mean, my initial reaction to it was to think that he was drunk. I wrote to him and I said to him, wow, dude, you want me to put this down to you being drunk or copy this to media, you know, just to see where the hell the guy lay. I said, it's a tough choice for you to make, but my advice is that this is a moment where you need to think very hard, you know? So I wrote back to him saying that, and he came back saying, I'm not drunk, you know, and it was very weird.
Oh my goodness.
So this is kind of the we have to be ready, I believe, for any amount of derangement and unraveling and just, contradictory, mutually annihilating ideas emerging at a very rapid rate, unsettling stuff.
Well, I think that this reminds me of something that I was looking at yesterday. Oddly enough, it was another doctor who was completely unhinged. But I was talking, you know, with William about this, and I was like, I think that he really believes it, though. This is the difference between the medical population who are part of the mass formation and the regular person who just kind of yells at you at the supermarket for not wearing your mask properly. Like, it's very different because they have put all of their... It's all of their energy, all of their, they've invested every single part of themselves, their identity as being a frontline hero, as being, you know, a medical person, as being somebody who knows science, who knows medicine, and who is to be trusted. They're an authoritative figure and all of this. And they've really bought it. And they felt like they've been, some people really do feel like all of this has been to save people. And they don't understand economics. And they don't understand how damaging lockdowns have been, because it's been completely the opposite for them. They've actually, many of them have received, you know, bonuses and extras and this and that. Some of them have had their practices at home. The ones who have been in the ER have had the perk of feeling like a hero. So there's all of these different incentives for them to cling to the fact that they've done the right thing here.
Yeah, and I think the doctors are in a very a real pickle, because I think a lot of them pride themselves as being in some way scientific. But they've gone for the worst elements. They're not, you know, people have this reaction all the time, but you're not a doctor. What do you know about epidemiology or about transmission mechanisms of viruses? Well, you know, hello. Doctors don't know a whole lot about that stuff either, and they actually are poorly equipped, because their study is very broad. They have to learn a little bit about a lot of things. And so their mathematics isn't good. Their statistics isn't good. Their virology isn't good. Their genetics isn't good. Their immunology isn't good. You know, if you want to study the immunology studied by a doctor, it's not going to take you more than a couple of days. A general practitioner. You know, it's really not difficult either. And epidemiology even more so. It's a, you know, the average paper is like very, very easy to read. It's not if you've got some mathematics, you know, not a lot. Undergraduate mathematics definitely will do. And a person who has, you know, achieved well at school and remembers a little bit of statistics and calculus, you can, those papers are very accessible. They're not at all rocket science. And so the stuff's actually A, accessible, and be shallow. So, you know, the refuting the nonsense is a bit harder, because you have to go into the epistemology and explain, look, you can't use this kind of method for that kind of problem. It's just fundamentally wrong. And explaining all of that to a person who doesn't have that the breadth of education and reading, that's harder. You know, the old truism that it takes a bucket of common sense to dispel a teaspoon of irrationality, or however the saying goes, is very much the case in a lot of the stuff that's gone on. A lot of this so-called scientific evidence, which is for the most part very low quality model-based work, or, you know, simplistic experiments that have been conjured up to demonstrate that masks stop large droplets or do something or other, or turn your hair purple or whatever.
Well, you know, let's actually take this and go. I have a little bit of a direction to throw at you, just for maybe even a couple of minutes. All of that is the same kind of things that have been used for the whole climate change narrative, modeling. Mm-hmm. Like the IPCC, it's all based on models. It's all based on cherry-picking data. Same thing with big food, right? If you looked at kind of back in, you know, 15 years ago or so, when you had Tim Noakes, who was on trial, the South African, right? Yeah. And that was because he was going against the narrative that the food pyramid has been based on for 50 years or 60 years. And everybody is obese because of it, and everybody has diabetes and all of this kind of thing. Yeah. So climate change, right? Like that was kind of there before COVID. It wasn't popular enough. It was pretty fringe still, but they were really, really pushing that this was what we had to do. We had to reshape our society around climate change, around, you know, this crisis. But they weren't that effective, right? And then suddenly you have COVID, and it's this catalyst for a green recovery. And this is where, like, we're stuck on COVID. We're always talking about that. We've gone through everything that there is to do. And we know that people don't care about the facts. You know, that's not really... like for certain people on certain fronts, there have been battles that have been won. There have been battles that have been lost. But the next thing that's actually coming is climate change and climate lockdowns. and that they're going to apply the same methods in order to keep a totalitarian system going that forces everybody to remain controlled.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, let's just, before we get into whether that's the direction of travel, it's maybe useful to dwell upon the parallels between the construction of the COVID narrative and the climate change narrative.
Yes.
You know, you've got a Neil Ferguson in climate science as well. There are a couple of candidates. There's a guy by the name of James Hansen, and then there's the hockey stick idiot called Michael Mann.
Yes.
So you've got these guys who, you know, whose models have been completely refuted with the passing of time. And everybody has, well, not everybody, but a lot of people who've been reading mainstream media will have those charts and, you know, that were used to argue for flatten the curve in COVID. They also have the charts of the hockey stick in their minds when it comes to climate change. But the fact that that those charts were just wrong, and that Al Gore threatening us all with London and Manhattan being underwater by 2010 was clearly a few years out. you know, those facts passed the population by in a way, in the same way that the failure of those models to materialize, you know, when The Guardian was calling Sweden a bunch of murderous thugs and saying and predicting that they would have tens of thousands of excess deaths within a couple of weeks. It only took a couple of weeks for those propositions to be completely falsified, but nobody noticed, you know. So it's the same. And then, of course, there's the parallel where dissident scientists are cancelled and can't get funding and can't get grant money. And end up living in the hills in Colorado, sort of thing. There's that. And then there's also the electric fence around the issue on social media. I mean, YouTube has come out saying that they're also going to deplatform not just COVID misinformation, but climate misinformation. Mm-hmm. So the parallels are extreme. And of course, the other thing that has to be mentioned is, of course, all of these things, and along with many other fabricated crises, end up in the WEF's World Risk Report on an annual basis, a very serious piece, the World Risk Report. And I recommend to anybody with a brain to pick that document up and have a quick look at it, because it is spectacular. Intellectual shallowness is extreme. They put these words up, and each word is like a risk. Oh, it's a global risk, you know, global risk. And we put these words up on a page, and they every now and then they do a rearrangement of how they put them on the page. And then there's a think tank type organization or futurology type people who go and draw lines between the words.
Yes.
And it's actually like a real conspiracy theorist, you know. Mm-hmm. There they are. They've got, the risk. And then the lines are coming out and they're joining, and there's a picture. And that's what the document looks like. There's nothing academic or intellectual or philosophical or, you know, the epistemology is nowhere to be seen.
Yes.
That's what it is. And they put this thing together with input from thousands of CEOs from the world's most important companies, you know. But it's drivel from beginning to end, complete drivel.
Yeah. I think that's right. And you look at also some other elements here, is that you have Antonio Guterres, who is, you know, the UN's leader, who is from the Communist Party, like he's a member of that. You look as well at the very foundations. Like, let's go backwards, because what I'm trying to do here is figure out where did this all begin, because we're clearly going down the road to serfdom. And we're pretty far along. So if you look at 1992, the Rio de Janeiro Convention on Climate, whatever it was called at that point, not climate change, but whatever it was. This was basically the stepping stone. Yeah, for global warming, right? There you go. So this was the stepping stone. But look at the year. You have 1991 is the fall of the Soviet Union officially. 1991. But the very next year, we go here.
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah. then if you look even before that, you look at the end of the Second World War, and then you have the UN comes out of that. Like 2 years yes. later, the UN is founded, the World Wildlife Foundation is founded. All of these organizations that are centered around population and weather and population control, basically, and controlling the weather and all kinds of hubristic, anti-humanistic yeah. things.
Yeah.
And so then you have like, it's like as if they became the vessels for this ideology that was never dying, which was like, humans are the problem somehow. Like that's kind of the underlying current.
Sort of the four horsemen of the Malthusian apocalypse kind of.
Yes, exactly.
You know, yeah.
Exactly.
And Malthusianism is a really bad idea. It has a nasty feature, which is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because you know, if you follow the prescriptions of Malthusianism, you cut off knowledge growth. And it is knowledge growth that enables us to do more with less on an infinite basis. This is not this whole sort of analogy of spaceship Earth and somehow we're going to run out of everything is wrong yeah. in the presence of knowledge creation. Knowledge yes. creation is indefinite, infinite. And provided you allow the conditions of conjecture and criticism to pertain. And Malthusianism shuts those down.
Yes. That's a very important point.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other reality, of course, is that it's a well-known fact that impoverishing people leads to increases in birth rates.
Yes.
So yes. Their own ideas, that if they want to reduce population, they would have to do so by way of mandating contraceptives. Mm-hmm. And if you think that that people of this ilk are how eager they've been to mandate vaccines, imagine how they're going to feel about mandating contraceptives. They'll be even more enthusiastic. Right. So I kind of think that that's the, in their heads, that's the kind of solution that has to be entertained. But of course, the best solution would be to allow freedom and liberal values and freedom of speech, continuation of conjecture and criticism and creation and generativity to continue. And then people become more wealthy and it's no longer yes. optimal for them to have 5 kids per fecund woman. You get what we've seen in the wealthy countries, which is greening and mm-hmm. more money available to spend on environmental and ecological projects. None of that exists in the poor South. Most countries are simply unable to police the most modest of campaigns. So you have massive deforestation and environmental and ecological destruction. This is kind of what they're locking in by impoverishing so many people in such a grand way through not just COVID, but this entire narrative that takes us in the direction of centralized control and what you've referred to as serfdom and the feudal structure. Yeah. I see more of a fascist kind of environment with feudal and feudal kind of elements. But
yeah.
Let's not split hairs. That's where we're going. And it's going to worsen all of the problems that these guys imagine are actually global problems, when in reality they're local problems caused by the non-existence of the very systems that these people are destroying.
So this morning when I was reading a little bit of the origins of totalitarianism, I got mm-hmm. into the topic of imperialism. And Hannah Arendt mm-hmm. was saying how basically after the Second World War and the end of the Cold War, that we might end up with the same kind of problem that led to the First World War, which is the move back towards imperialism. And that's basically, you know, wanting to, like, how would you define imperialism? This is what I wanted to ask you and what you think about that, because I kind of look at it as wanting to take over as much space as possible and also to... Mm-hmm. To control it among a certain group of elites. That'd be pretty accurate.
I mean, I guess my head model for imperialism is the Julian and Augustine Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because I went through the labor of love of reading all six volumes of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Wow.
And I'd studied Latin at school and everything, so it was all pretty close to my heart. and the sense you got there is yes, there's this very strong desire to control other human beings, very strong sense of the imperative of centralizing.
Yeah.
And it's a fatally flawed project. This leads to the ultimate demise of what was the most vibrant culture in the world for hundreds of years. So I kind of see it as it combines elements of the desire to control both space and people.
Yeah.
And hubristic notions of the ability to deploy whatever tools of judgment or calculation to improve the outcomes, to deal with the complex problems.
Yes. So-called improving the outcomes, right? Like it's funny. Like anytime you see the outcomes being a call to improve outcomes, you know, from a central authority, always makes things worse. Like this is absolutely true. But yet over and over again, there's always some that are willing to say, but I know how to do it best, so let's follow it this way, right? And then you have people say, but why would you say that decentralization is better? What makes you think, what gives you the hubris to think that a decentralized model is better than a centralized model, right? That could be, if I'm going to be devil's advocate, what would you say to that?
Well, that's quite simple. There's a huge difference. The decentralized model is the one that is humble, where you acknowledge the true complexity of the world and of society and of even single human bodies, a huge variety of things are. When you get into the weeds, you realize just how truly complex anything worthy of being called a problem is. Because of that feature of complexity, this idea that you can somehow step away from it and perform some kind of analytical modeling exercise and make predictions of consequences and trajectories from your own designed interventions is exposed. You know, that's a very hubristic notion. We're on very good grounds to say that the only way in which knowledge is created is in an evolutionary process. And it's that, you know, if you look at genetic evolution of organisms, each sexual combination or mutation is a trial and error process. It's a conjecture and a criticism. What's the conjecture? Well, whatever the mutation says or the sexual combination says, that's your... Yeah, here's a proposal for something that might survive, okay? And then the test is the criticism is the survival of the fittest test. So that's the analogy in biology. In social and political science domains, you've got this very complex organism, society, and you want to be making small changes on the margins, tinkering in the nature of a mutation, or putting things together, putting ideas together or constructs together as an analogy to sexual combination, and seeing what happens before you go and try and prescribe them for the entire system.
Yes.
So this is fundamental to knowledge. What I'm expressing here, this analogy between biology and and political science is not some interesting coincidence or something like that. That is the fundamental nature of knowledge.
Yes.
Deductive knowledge, inductive knowledge, the stuff that, you know, you can learn in a geometry textbook, that's useless. That doesn't solve new problems. That's all simply reflecting isomorphisms of the same problem or the same solution. And so it really is fundamental to it. It's essential to the structure of knowledge that you need to have distributive, competitive conjecture and distributive, competitive criticism in order for knowledge creation to take place at all.
Yeah. That was really well said. And if I can untangle that, what I would say about it to mirror it back to you would be basically you have systems that are developed by different minds and like, well, this is the best way to run it. Like, you know, Marxism, let's say, or, you know, socialism or yeah. something else. But then you have something that's more like laissez-faire markets really means like leave it alone. It literally means that leave it alone and things will kind of happen naturally. They will happen by the way that kind of like in the same way that you're using that analogy there biologically, it happens in interactions between people, right? Where they, if you kind of leave everybody mostly alone, they will figure out the best way to work things out with the people around them in terms of trade, in terms of social relationships. And, you know, by having less intervention, you know, especially from the top, maybe little intervention from the people around to say, there's the criticism, right? Oh, I don't think that this is working. You know, I see you trading with your neighbor and ripping him off. So, you know, let me come in there and see if I can do something about it. But the closer that you are to the minority, which is the individual, the smallest minority, right? The easier it is to see that this decentralized way of looking at things is just kind of the natural way that things go. And so it's not really a system that has been invented by a mind. It's just the way that things are.
Okay, let's play with that a little bit. Because I don't entirely agree with that kind of analysis. The point I make quite often is that, and I usually make the point to illustrate the complexity of the system we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. But I make the point that your political systems should never be considered optimal in some scale independent way. What's true at a more local level or a more regional level or a more family level mm-hmm. may be completely false by the time you scale up to the level of the world or any intermediate step like a nation state. So I borrow the notion that, you know, in my household, things are run on a very communist basis. Everybody gets equal health care, even though I have most of the income.
Yeah.
And it would never be otherwise. There's no set of circumstances in which I envisage sending my child for inferior attention to the attention I get or eating, they're not going to eat a worse meal. So it's a communist system in operation at Chateau Hudson. But by the time I get up to the United Nations or the World Health Organization, I'm a rabid anarcho-libertarian. You know, I really want to depose the monarch. And
yes.
I think that construct is very important. It's going to be that kind of idea is going to be essential to undoing the polarization. You've got to be able to say there is a place for hierarchy. There is a place for organization. Mm-hmm. There is a place for the greater good. But that place is not the United Nations.
Yeah. I see what you're saying, and I can respect that a lot. I just think that the way that I perceive it is different. And it's that what you're expressing there in your own household, you know, of giving equal healthcare to all, even though you are, it's basically dividing the fruits of your labor. So I understand what you mean there, but I don't see that as being a communist thing. I see that as being voluntary, because it's in your best interest to say, I am going to take my wealth and distribute it among my family. It's a voluntary thing. Like, nobody is imposing that upon you. So I see what you're saying, but I don't think that's exactly it. Okay. Yeah. That's a good point. Go on.
Yeah. The children might disagree. You know, the rules are set by the parents and so on. And
yes. Let's
take one step out of my front door into the community.
Okay.
Then immediately we look at the same set of considerations. And there I find myself quite socialist. You know, I really don't, it doesn't sit well with me to have neighbors or proximate friends who are suffering and nobody doing anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of my instinct there is to kind of say, no, look, I think it's reasonable to kind of put quite a lot of pressure on subscription to our security enclave. You know, South Africa, because the police are useless, everybody who has the wherewithal pays for private security.
Yeah.
And I look at that and I say, yeah, it makes sense for us as a community to come together and for everybody to subscribe.
Yeah.
And, you know, to kind of, if not making it compulsory, then being quite close to doing so, in the sense that there's quite a lot of community stigma attached to anybody who doesn't play along. So it's a form of coercion.
Right.
And I'm not uncomfortable with that.
But that's still different to me, Nick, because it's still not the state who's imposing that, right? It's the social pressure, which means that it's voluntary. It's still voluntary. It could be seen as coercive because it's your neighbors, right? And there's a social coercion, but there's not the monopoly on violence, the state who's there with a gun to your head that says, if you don't pay this, you know, then you're going to end up in the can. It's still different.
There's some shades of gray, but it is a political organization. It's the homeowners. What do we call ourselves? I've forgotten now. It's not going to come to me. But anyway, let's just call it the homeowners committee or whatever. And they have a certain power vested in them by their election onto this group on an annual basis. And they have some violent capacity in the sense that they can ostracize and stigmatize people.
Okay.
I will give you this much. It's easier to opt out than opting out of a nation state.
Mm-hmm.
But I would urge people to think about things in a continuum. You know, when you get to the level of the world, it's hard to opt out of the system, right?
Yeah.
Going to Mars might be on Elon Musk's menu, but it's not on mine.
Yeah.
And so it becomes then the question that you're talking about, the monopoly of violence, becomes very important. At the level of the nation state, it's still quite important. At the level of the province or the U.S. state, well, you've seen what happens there. A lot of people left California to go to Texas and Florida because they thought that the Californian polity was bananas. And and then by the time you get down to the suburb level or the household level, escape becomes a more realistic proposition. And so the monopoly of violence is not as acute, but it's a continuum. And we need, my proposition would be that we need to not go to reductionist thinking. We're all sitting here criticizing the reductionist thinking, the scientific thinking of the of the public health officials. But we should also adopt the same mindset towards the political thinking, reductionist political thinking, atomized political thinking, where we kind of take this view of laissez-faire and individual liberties to an extreme is is I don't believe reflective of the true spirit of humanity. And we can split hairs on what's voluntary and what's not, and is that, you know, is this this kind of, but the reality is that we're always building hierarchies, and we have to be mindful of them. There's a continuous need to dismantle hierarchies when they ossify and become too violent. They have too much of a monopoly on violence. Yeah. And there's a need to build hierarchies when we are dealing with situations of atomization, where people lack a sense of community. So if this is sounding oxymoronic or
no, I don't think so.
A bit yin and yang-ish. Well, yes, exactly. There's a balancing act, you know, that needs to be performed, and it's for that reason that I personally resist the application of labels so hard. I don't give myself a lot of labels. And I resist the imposition of them on me because it depends. Where are we? What are the circumstances? Who are we talking about? The balance will be different.
It's a really good point. And I don't know that I have all of the counter arguments to it. You know, I'm just trying to kind of figure out what is the best way to go about things. And I think that it's really interesting to hear your perspective on it, because you're in South Africa and your system is very different than here in Canada, like where we're very far, you know, down the socialist route. And so I have, you know, a personal opposition to that, because I'm seeing how that's affected us as a country, you know, and we're just sinking. And and so it's really tough to figure out what is the best way. And then, of course, I'm exposed to a lot of free market ideas, you know, with the authors at the American Institute for Economic Research. And they provide really, really great arguments for it. I mean, one of the texts that I just read was by an author, Richard Ebeling, and he spent time in the Soviet Union and, you know, did all of these kinds of things and writes extensively about socialism. And one of the things that he had written recently was that the Mayflower that came over, you know, to the U.S., that ship, you know, of the colonists, in their first winter, they had actually tried a kind of socialist experiment there. They had divided, you know, all of the work evenly and tried to create this little socialist utopia. I never knew this story. It's so interesting. Let me know if you know or not. But so they divided the work evenly, you know, everybody was supposed to help each other out. If, you know, I could be washing the laundry of the guy next door if he needed an extra hand. And it was done literally in that fashion. But what ended up happening was that people got resentful really quickly. You know, they were like, why do I have to work so hard when this guy's, you know, getting up late? He's not working as hard, you know, in the field and this and that. And of course, that's where you see like socialism typically leads to famines and supply chain issues and things like that, because people just don't work as hard as if it was voluntary and as if it was for their own best interest. And then so they ended up losing like half of the people there. And then the next year around, they said, and it wasn't completely laissez-faire, right? There was still some organization and there was still hierarchy. But they said, well, now what we're going to do is we're going to give you guys all some of your own land. It was kind of feudal in a way, right? We'll give you some of your own land, and then you can do what you want with that piece of land. And then there was more abundance. Then there was, okay, well, now I'm going to really get in the field. I'm going to plant my crops. I'm going to make sure that we get fed. And everybody was kind of more jolly-hearted about it. And they went about and did their work knowing that they would reap the seeds of that labor. And then they took the extras and they were exchanging with their neighbors. Yes. So I don't know if that's truly laissez-faire or not, but it's closer to that on the spectrum.
It's directionally in that sort of heading towards laissez-faire. So yeah, and don't get me wrong. I mean, I think that there's a overwhelming kind of drift towards centralism, which I resist. And so my direction of thought at the moment is towards liberalism, individual rights, all of these kind of constructs, which would find a happy home in most libertarians' hearts. Mm-hmm. But I also think we have to acknowledge the incredible atomization that gave rise to use Matthias Desmet's perspective for a moment, to the free-floating anxiety.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if you've ever read the books of Welbeck. I forget his first name right now, but French author, quite a peculiar man. I've never found him entirely savory in some way. There's a kind of prurience to his writing, which I don't enjoy very much. But what he read, the truth that he really strikes very well, is the idea of this sense of a untethered individuals, atomized individuals. In fact, I think one of his books was called, either in French or English, Atomized.
Yes.
And that sense of disconnectedness, of the collapse of community, is, I think, something that we all have to think really hard about. And mobility was part of that story. The United States led the way, where I think already in the 1980s, when Alvin Toffler wrote his book, The Third Wave, he could say something to the effect that the average person lives in a town for 5 years, something like that. I'm really stretching back to my teenage years when I read that book. But that there's something wrong in that system too. And we need to face up to this, because a lot of our problems today are because of those problems, where we spent too little time thinking about community, the greater good. Maybe what happened was we started trying to locate the sense of community on an ever larger scale, and that project collapsed.
Yes.
So the nation state started appropriating the responsibilities of the parish or the bowling club. Bowling Alone, that's a book that wrote about this kind of thing, or Neil Ferguson, not Neil Ferguson of COVID infamy, but the economic historian. You know, he writes quite eloquently, or speaks quite eloquently, about the dissolution of community in Wales and America. And I think he's spot on. That's the root of a lot of this. So where do we, we've got to throw all of these ideas into the mix and start thinking about whether it isn't time to cherry pick, to use the phrase, some ideas from the pot of greater good and some ideas from the pot of extreme anarcho-libertarianism.
Yeah.
And think of different ways of doing things from what the Davos set has in mind for us.
I think that's something to think about for sure. I definitely don't believe in the greater good. I just, and I have many, many reasons for that, but I know, I understand what you mean though, even if I don't agree with all of it. And I think that there's something to be said there. I do think one of the things as well that has led to that kind of separation of the individual, who's really gone kind of far out and drifts by themselves, is the spiritual question. A lot of it does also come back to that, because if you look at the founding of the United States, when they were more free market, they also did have more communities. So that it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't go hand in hand. Like, I would argue that the U.S. and all of these, kind of free liberal societies have moved away from that. Like, they've become more consumerist and individualist in a different sense than that kind of protection of individual rights, but strong tethering to your community. And usually that meant a religious feature, right? Like, it was usually a church that people would go to. There was some kind of feature that kept people together, but it wasn't owned by the state. And so that's a big part of it. We've talked about this, before, where it's now the state religion has kind of taken over. So yeah, people can float around and be individualist and be tethered to nothing. And that's also a result of the loss of some kind of spiritual communities and structures.
Yeah. No, I can go along with that entirely. And it is the right way to engage, and it is in this kind of discourse. It's not to rush into a spreadsheet and try and prove a theorem.
I'm waiting for your models. I'm waiting for you to send me
your
spreadsheet.
Utilitarian calculus of the non-scale invariance of political systems coming your way, Kate, tomorrow morning.
Yeah, that's it. And here is, you know, this is one of the reasons I don't believe in the greater good, okay? Because it is part of utilitarianism. Actually, one of the definitions of the greater good is the aggregation of all of the, what is it? Of the most pleasure minus the most pain. In the aggregate sense, is the greater good, right? So, like, that to me doesn't exist in that sense of the word, right? So, this is where I come from.
No, it's so absurd. Evaluating society with respect to a measure, which is what you're doing always with utilitarianism. Let's not rush past that. What is a measure? It's a point in time assessment according to some chosen dimension.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've suffered through the last 2 years is COVID mortality. Official COVID mortality became the official measure. When? Now. Okay. Official COVID mortality now, or this week, or 2 weeks. Let's make it 2 weeks because that's what they kept on talking about.
Yeah.
So official COVID mortality in 2 weeks' time, that's the thing we all have to minimize at all costs. Yeah. It's a very utilitarian framework, and there's a naivety in the entire system because the second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth order effects just don't enter the spreadsheet.
Yeah.
This is a wonderful little, you know, the philosophers of ethics love these trolley problems, and a lot of them are absurd and talk about everything except what they should be talking about. But one that I quite like is the story of the healthy man in the doctor's waiting room. You know that one? And the people arrive and the doctor says, Sorry, Mr. Hudson, it's your unlucky day. If I remove all your essential organs, I can save all these other five patients. Would you mind sitting down? And then,
exactly.
And in one sense of utilitarian, in some easily envisaged utilitarian construct, that is a greater good situation. You kill the healthy guy and distribute his organs to the five unhealthy guys. And so five people have life and one person has lost life. Wow, greater good has been increased. You know, our utility has been promoted. But it's very easy for anybody with, you know, half a brain to say that if that was the way the world worked, there would be chaos.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
We can't all walk about worrying about whether tomorrow's our last day because my death might save two lives elsewhere.
Well, there is chaos. Chaos. And this is why. I mean, look, you have the perfect example of this. You just gave one. And here's another one in the whole COVID thing, is that everybody in the world should be vaccinated.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. At all costs.
Yes.
And at all, after whatever circumscriptions of individual liberties and rights and freedoms and values is required. Yeah.
Yes. And a child, you know, who may have myocarditis and have long-term heart problems, or, you know, somebody who's 35 and healthy and dies of a heart attack. And that's all, it's all okay, because the sum that we are looking for is this. And what's really interesting about utilitarianism too, is it's said to focus on the ends, right? Like achieving those ends. And everything else should be fine along the way, right? But this is not how things actually work. So, and then you'll never achieve the ends that you were looking for anyways. If you're not paying attention to the means, you'll never be able to get to the ends.
And the solution to that, or the replacement system for utilitarianism, isn't some other spreadsheet. You know, it's there you look to how we actually engage culturally our inherited traditions. Mm-hmm. Those solve for problems that we've lost sight of. And so, and it's because of the losing sight that the evolutionary approach needs to be the way that you, you don't go and make wholesale changes to society. You tinker on the margins, and you experiment with smaller groups or with, you know, your breakaway communities, your enclaves, your religious minorities. They're all doing these. They're all running the experiments for us, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And if they do well on it and thrive, then people will join them and be persuaded by their vision, even if the vision is not actually understood by the people who are practicing it, you know?
Yes.
Because it's so complex. So, yeah, it really is. Again, I go back to that idea of ideology, system, label, category as being woefully inadequate ways of thinking about the true and beautiful complexity. Yes. of the universe, of humanity, of individual human beings. If you start with a basic sense of awe and wonder and at that, and if you see in that its own essential beauty, then you will be loath to try and implement your grand plan.
Yeah. Nick, I'm going to tell everybody that you are human, non-binary.
Yes, I'm non-binary. I'm non-binary. What on earth happened? How did this happen?
That was beautifully said, though. I mean, that's really lovely. I just was thinking that and kind of chuckling to myself. But, you know, I think that you're right. I think this is a great way to look at things, though. You know, if you get caught in any ideological kind of loop, you can miss a lot of the complexity, and you can miss the best thing because you're looking for something that you've predetermined is going to be the answer to the question.
Mm. Yeah. Good way to finish, Kate.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that little summation of yours.
I think this is what the podcast will be called. It's going to be called Human Non-Binary. And then this way we can, you know, hopefully we can have some clickbait for all types of audiences to feel safe and to feel welcome enough to come and listen. That's the goal.
It'll be news at Panda in the morning. Nick goes non-binary. That's going to be
I'm definitely going to troll you about this. I'm not joking.
Yeah, I'm going to get trolled. Yeah.
Okay, Nick, get back to your stuff. And thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. And my apologies to your little boy.
If you value our work, please visit very-opinionated.com to help support our productions.